Thank you. My name is Vincent, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Rachel will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Vanessa will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Vanessa, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Kareth will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Kareth, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Ellen M.
Thank you. Good evening, I'm an alcoholic and my name is Ellen. And I'm happy to be here tonight. I appreciate having been asked to be here. My home group is the Into Action Big Book Group of Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. I think I heard somebody say something. Somebody knows my group. My sober date is December 9th, 2003. And I'll talk a little bit about my group in a minute. Should I speak a little louder? Okay. I'm always afraid to speak too loud, so that's the problem. So I guess in a general way, what it used to be like is, I can remember just feeling restless, irritable, and discontented from the moment I can remember. Don't really have happy memories from childhood. Always felt less than. Always felt that I couldn't measure up to those around me. And so I made a decision pretty early that I probably just shouldn't even try to do that, to measure up. And what's worse was that I was in this family that was really pretty content all of the time. So not only did I feel this way, but I was the only one around me that felt this way. I come from a family of non-alcoholics, really, really normal, my immediate family anyway, pretty normal people. And I was just there, and I was just this bundle of emotions and really miserable most of the time. So I made this decision that I wasn't really going to try too hard, to do much of anything. When I was eight years old, I really unintentionally found a solution to the way I felt. I was very manipulative, very dishonest from the beginning. I would lie, manipulate people and situations. I learned how that came naturally to me. And so I found a solution to this feeling when I was 8 years old. I was at this wedding, and we were sitting at this kid's table, and they gave everybody a glass of champagne. And there were 10 kids, and they gave everybody a glass, and everybody knew that they shouldn't drink that because they were, I don't know. I was eight. I was in the middle. So say we were 6 years old to 12 years old, and everybody knew they shouldn't drink it. And I said, "Yeah, but they're giving it to us, so let's do it." And I remember very well. I had no idea. I wasn't intending on getting drunk. I just knew that was something I shouldn't be doing, and I had an opportunity to do something I shouldn't be doing, and I could get away with it. So why would I not take that opportunity? And I learned, I learned why I shouldn't be drinking at that moment. I unintentionally got drunk, and everything was, it was just incredible. It was absolutely incredible from that moment. And, like I said, I didn't know what I was doing, but I got drunk and just enjoyed the rest of the night. And really just sought that feeling pretty much from that point on. I was seeking out drugs and alcohol by the time I was 12. I was 10 years old, and I was smoking cigarettes and other things. And by the time I was 12, I was pretty regularly drinking and involved in behaviors I shouldn't be involved in. So it just continues like that. It continues like that through high school, and things just get worse. You know, things just get worse. And at one point, I really didn't want to live. I really wanted to die, and I wasn't going to commit suicide. I knew I wasn't going to. But I thought that might get myself some attention, and maybe I could get help for this feeling that I had, that I still had, you know, that I was now using alcohol to try to fix. But I thought maybe if I tried to kill myself, I could get somebody could possibly help me in some way. So I didn't try, but I told people I wanted to, and that got me hospitalized. And I was seeking for a specific diagnosis so I would get specific medication. And I got it. I very easily got it. Oh my God, it's been 5 minutes already. Okay. So I very easily got this diagnosis, and I lied to those that were trying to help me. And, I used this medication along with everything else, and I didn't get any better. Didn't get any better at all. And so that was, you know, that's just how it continues for a while. And eventually, since we're past 5 minutes, I need to move on here. Eventually, I wind up within 4 minutes of death, 2 minutes of permanent brain damage from a night of partying. And I thought maybe I needed to take a look at my life. Because throughout all of this, I never lost faith in God. I was raised in a very strong religious. We had, you know, a very, very strong faith, and I never lost faith in God. I always prayed my entire life. I always had a connection to God, and I just thought, I don't think this is how God wants me to be living my life, and I think maybe some things need to change. And so, you know, after this near-death experience, I wound up in AA, and I went to this meeting, and it was me and five old men. That was the entire meeting, and which was kind of okay for me because I had a big problem with women, so this was kind of okay. I went to this meeting once a week for a while, and just all I did was tell these guys my problems, and they listened to me, and that was it. And this continues for about 6 months, and I'm going to some other meetings and not really finding anything worthwhile is what I thought. So I just kept going out. I was 19 years old, kept going in and out. And then, eventually it just gets worse, and it gets bad enough. And I just one day said to, you know, just kind of decided, let me do what I'm told. Let me do something that these people tell me to do, because I wasn't getting a sponsor, I wasn't going to meetings often, I wasn't doing anything I was told, and I was expecting something to change. So I said, let me just see where this goes, because I can always kill myself. That was really what I thought. That was my alternative. Let me give this a try for, I don't know what I really had in my head, whether it was 90 days or whether it was a year, but I just knew I could always kill myself. That was always there. So let me see what happens. Let me do what they say, and let me see what happens. So I got a sponsor the next day, and she said, "Okay, we're gonna get together." It was like a Tuesday. She said, "We're gonna get together on Friday." Okay, you're gonna come to my house. Okay, I don't know what's going on. Whatever. I think I'm gonna be there for like a half hour or something. She says, "Bring your big book." Okay, I'll bring my big book. So I bring my big book. And before we opened the book, she just said to me, this may not work out. This doesn't always, you know, people don't always click. This may not work out. So I just want you to know that if this doesn't work out, please find another sponsor who works the steps out of the big book with her sponsor, and who will do that with you. That's all I ask of you if this doesn't work out. Okay. So what I thought was going to be a half hour wound up being like 3 or 4, and I thought, this is insane, and we're going to be doing this every Friday for how long, you know? So that was how it went. You know, that was what we did. And, you know, things changed. Wow, it's been, okay, 1 minute. things really did start to change pretty quickly for me, because that's how it was done. And, you know, because I only have a minute left, there's not a whole lot more I could say about the rest of the 4 years. You know, I did want to say that I did spend a period of time that I wasn't active in this work, and I suffered tremendously, and those around me suffered even more. You know, I just want to say that what she told me that day was the absolute truth, that I need to be working with some, you know, now I need to be taking others through this, and I need to have someone to guide me that lives this as a way of life. That's pretty much, I guess, what keeps me here, what gets me through every day, and close to God. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Supriya.
Right-sized microphone. Hi, my name is Supriya. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Giro for asking me to speak. The vital stats first. My home group is the Atlantic Group. Rajesh is my sponsor. Working steps 9 through 12. And my sobriety date is March 9th, 2006. So a little bit about how I wound up here. I drank a few times in my teens, and I didn't actually think much of it. I drank, I got a buzz, it was a pleasant feeling. I had one or two drinks on each of these occasions, and you know, I felt a little looser, you know, I felt a little more comfortable, but it wasn't a big deal to me. And then when I was 17, I was down the shore for about a week after graduation, and the first night was the first time I got really, really drunk. And, you know, for the first time, like, I had a drink, and then I had another one and another one. I lost count of how much I had drank. And at this point, I didn't know the consequences of drinking with abandon, so I just kept drinking. And I did some really embarrassing things. I got physically sick. And the next morning I woke up and I felt remorseful and ashamed and embarrassed. But at the same time, I woke up with this resolve to drink as much as I could without becoming ill. You know, like I didn't resolve not to drink ever again. I resolved to drink as much as I could without getting ill. So there was something very appealing to me about the way it felt to be drunk. You know, the sensation of not having fit in my whole life, in school, etc., that just was lifted in an instant. And that was something that, was remarkable to me. And so that week went on, and we drank continuously that whole week, all of us. There's no adult supervision, so we're drinking every day, and it's going pretty well. I'm doing well, finding my limits, so to speak. And the third or fourth night, the group resolves to take a night off from drinking. And I say to them, "What do you mean? Like there's nobody here that we're going to get in trouble with if we drink. There's alcohol in the fridge. What do you mean we're not going to drink?" And I drank by myself. I was the only one who drank. And one of my friends said, "You know, you might be an alcoholic." And, you know, it only took a short 10 years for me to figure that out for myself. So, on to college. You know, drinking is becoming more and more a part of my life, and I'm actively seeking it out. So, like, my first year, I have friends that drink maybe once every 3 weeks, and so I drink once every 3 weeks, and I get ridiculously drunk when I drink. And then the next year, I just happened to find a group of friends that drinks every weekend. And then in the summer after that, I just happened to find a group of friends that drinks every day. You know, so in addition to this thing where, you know, unlike most of my friends, when they, once they got accustomed to drinking, they knew where their limits were. At some point in the evening, they would say, okay, I've had enough, I've stopped. I never did find that line. In addition to that, I'm constantly preoccupied with drinking. Like, I'm always worried about, is there going to be enough alcohol? Who's bringing it? You know, who's bringing the mixers for the alcohol? I'm never once in all these years of partying did it occur to me to, like, call people up and see if they were going to the party. It didn't matter to me. My focus was on the alcohol. And so that went on through college, and at the end of college, I got myself into some pretty serious trouble. Serious enough that I resolved to stop drinking. In my last semester in college, I didn't drink. And as a consequence of this trouble, I had to go to some kind of alcohol class, and they made us take a quiz of how bad our drinking was. And for whatever reason, I decided to answer that quiz honestly, not realizing perhaps that they were collecting it. And so I was advised that I should find myself to an inpatient rehab. And I was like, I just stopped drinking for like six months on my own. Like, let me just go to AA. I'll just go to AA. And that was my first introduction to AA. I went once a week, and I got this little piece of paper signed, and I identified with some aspects of people's stories, and for whatever reason, I couldn't allow myself to completely identify. I would say that, you know, these folks are really down and out. They've got, you know, their whole lives have been torn apart, and I'm just a kid who drank too much in college. It was a phase. I stopped on my own. Shouldn't that be proof enough that, you know, I don't have what these people have? And I stayed stopped for 3.5 years. And one night, I just found myself feeling a little bit restless. You know, the 3.5 years where I stopped, it wasn't even a bad experience. Like, I did well academically. I've got settled in my career. Things were generally okay. But there was just this restlessness that came over me at one point, and I said, you know, maybe I know I can't drink safely, so maybe I'll go with this safer alternative to drinking, which I found. And it wasn't safer, but... And so that progressed for a number of years, and I found myself in a place where I was very unstable mentally, and I went to see a doctor, and among other things, in addition to the treatment he was offering me, he said, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting once, twice a week, floating in and out of different meetings. Didn't have a home group, didn't have a sponsor. And again, hanging on to this, I stopped on my own for 3.5 years. So, like, you know, I'm just stop on my own again. And for whatever reason, like, one of my friends said to me, you know, it's not even about the temptation to drink. You're setting up a foundation of very dry sobriety. And it was the first time the idea that there's more to this than just not drinking, that there's something like emotional sobriety, that like my behavior and my attitudes towards things were part of this. It was the first time that was introduced to me. And the same friend took me to a meeting where I met my sponsor and I heard him speak. And I really identified with what he had to say, and as I was walking out, my friend said to me, "Go back and get that guy's number," and I did. And it took me a few days to call him again. And you know, when we first spoke, you know, up to this point, I'd always thought of Alcoholics Anonymous as a support group, and he said to me, "We're going to go through this book, page by page, and you're going to learn, you're going to go through these steps, and you're going to apply these steps to your life, and you're going to have a new design for living. And it gave me something that I couldn't do on my own. If I could, I could stay without alcohol for an indeterminate period of months or years, but what I couldn't achieve on my own was permanent sobriety and a contented, useful life. Contented, useful life. Like, that had always escaped me, and that was here in this program. And I worked the steps. The first step, I think the powerlessness was clear. The unmanageability was very clear at this point, just because of how unstable things had gotten, how messy things had gotten. And, you know, it was explained to me that the whole point of these steps is to find a power. And that power is going to help me to change my attitudes and my actions. And that was the whole thing. It's been an amazing journey. And, you know, I'm sponsoring a couple guys now, and my instinct is to be like the wolf in Pulp Fiction. I want to go in and fix the situation. That's not my, you know, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. Like, I have to, my job is to show these guys how to apply these steps to their lives just like it was shown to me. And it's been an amazing, very rewarding experience. And I want to thank you all. And thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Cindy C.
My name is Cindy Coleman, and I'm an alcoholic. I thought there was a break. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is March 10th of 1977. Yes, I got sober when I was two. So you don't have to do the math. That's 32 years. I never planned on living this long, and I can't believe I'm this old. I'm an Eskimo from San Bernardino, northern San Bernardino. It's a little cooler there. There are not a lot of Eskimos from San Bernardino. And there are none now. I hated that place. And I knew I was just a displaced Eskimo princess. Ice floe just drifted a little too far south. Clancy's my sponsor. He's my 11th sponsor. He's been my sponsor for 28 years. So that tells you a little bit about my beginnings. I can't believe it's 28 years. I'll tell you one of the benefits of having a relationship that long is his voice is the outgoing message at his office when I call him. And when I hear his voice, it's just like, that's the beauty of calling somebody for that long. One of the many things that it's so good. I called Clancy when he first started sponsoring me. I had sponsor number 10 for 2 years. And she moved to Orange County, where all the old timers go. So I asked Clancy to sponsor me. And in the beginning, I called him 4 to 12 times a day. and not for just like a bad week out of the month. It was about 3 years. I happen to be what you call stark raving sober. I love to drink Southern Comfort, love Old English 800. Now, I don't know if you know anything about native drinkers. We either are alcoholics or we do not drink at all. There's no such thing as a social drinker. I drank poorly from the beginning. I threw up a lot, which was just part of the evening. I have numerous experiences that would make any normal drinker, any normal person, never pick up a drink again. But our book talks about it. It says, parallel with sound reasoning, we have an insane, trivial excuse for picking up the first drink. Shortly after I started drinking, my father, who was a probation officer, who handled drunk driving cases, went one afternoon to an AA meeting because he was sending all of his clients there. He wanted to go see what it's about, and this August he'll be sober 35 years. Then my hell really began. Like any good newcomer, he didn't work for his first year. He got his first job at Kellogg Mental Institution, graveyard shift running the adolescent unit. It was fantastic. He went to an AA meeting every single night, and after the meeting, he would go to work. Would come home about 8:30, 9 o'clock the next morning to a house filled with teenagers passed out all over the place. Because I have a brother 18 and a half months younger and 18 and a half months older, and we just crushed this poor man. My mother and father got divorced before my memory begins. I guess I was about 2 and a half, and she went back to Alaska where she lives now. And I didn't meet her until I was a year sober, so I have no recall of her. In San Bernardino, as I said, there weren't a lot of Eskimos. So it became apparent when I went to school that I did not look like everybody else. And I began to hate the way that I looked. I hated my eyes. And I would come home from school and I'd sit on the edge of my bed and stretch my eyes out so they'd become round. And it worked. But I started smoking dope and they just kind of... And by the end of the party, everybody looked like me, you know. I'm not really a druggie. Someone gave me amphetamines free for 2 weeks so that I would get, you know, hooked on them. And then he's like, you know, Cindy, I cannot keep giving you these for free. But when you feel like mowing the lawn at 2 o'clock in the morning... with a flashlight and fingernail clippers. It's like being sober plus. You know. Clancy sponsor Chuck used to say something that I loved. He said, I could not integrate myself into society. And that's the way I felt. I just could not make myself fit. And for some reason, when I drink the right amount of whiskey, I fit. I feel like I fit. And I drink not so much for me, but I drink for what it does for you. Because if I drink the right amount, you all of a sudden are lovable. And I'll spend hours telling you about it while I weep. I'm what Hank Jay used to call an emotional goober. When I'm sober, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can't stand the way that I feel. My father, I went to an AA meeting once to give him a cake. I don't remember anything that happened that night other than smoking pot out in the parking lot with my brothers. And I remember someone stayed sober for 30 days and they went up to the podium and they said their name and they received a white plastic chip. And I leaned over to my brother and I'm like, what a ripoff. I mean, do these people know how hard that is? And that's all he got was a white plastic chip. I did not have this big grand life that, you know, wiped out communities or religions. I can be found in the doctor's opinion when he says people like you are too heartbreaking. That's the way I drink. I broke my dad's heart over and over and over again. On my last drunk, my dad sat me down and told me that he was taking David to an AA meeting. David is 2 months older than I am. I met David in Alateen. I went to 2 meetings before they kicked me out because I showed up drunk both times. But I remember David, and I said, why are you taking David? He said, David is an alcoholic. I said, oh, God, I'm sorry. My dad said, why don't you join us? We're going to go hear a man named Chuck Seetalk. And Chuck hasn't had a drink in, I think it was 30 years. And I remember thinking, why would you want to go listen to someone who hasn't had a drink in 30 years? My dad did not have to work this particular evening, so he took David, the newcomer, a teenager, to the meeting. He came home, just heard Chuck C talk, just helped David, felt really spiritual, and walked into the house, and there were a bunch of kids there, as usual, and he had asked where I was, and they said, she went to bed, she's got a headache. And what had happened that night was a couple girls came over that I hadn't seen in a while. They brought a fifth of Southern Comfort. And I drank mine. I drank what was left in the bottle. And the way I look at things is if you're not done with yours, by the time I'm done with mine, I'm going to take yours. I call it sharing. I knew I couldn't hold it and sit down at the same time, so I carefully placed it on this arm of this chair and this couch that were next to each other. And as I sat down, I knocked the glass over. And I just started sobbing. Now, I was not based anywhere near reality, so it didn't dawn on me I could get more or steal more or somebody would bring more. That was just the last of the booze. So I'm sobbing. I all of a sudden get struck with a deep sense of love for my little brother, Marty. Marty and I used to get in several fist fights a week. So I'm going to go find him, and I'm going to tell him how much I love him. I knew he was 2 blocks away from the house at the local college, driving around with a security guard, smoking pot, looking for illegal activity. While I was out there, they came. This time, they had a cannon. They were firing it at me over and over and over. They kept firing little pieces of rock and glass and there were little chips lodged in my face. And I was so drunk, I didn't have any pain, but I could feel things lodged in my face. And I would wipe my face away, and the second I got it wiped, they'd fire another load at me. And I found out later what had happened was I was just climbing up a real steep hill, and with my dead drunken weight, I just kept going face down into the ground over and over and over. And they finally got me to the top of the hill in the alley behind my house, and my little brother and his best friend were lying against the garbage cans. And their shirts were ripped, and they had chains wrapped around their necks. And my little brother's best friend's brother was standing there, and he said the gang came by and took care of him. I used to be in a gang for a while. Gangs then aren't like they are now. I'm sure you've heard of us, the Seven Leafers. I see my little brother and his best friend lying there, and I start sobbing. And after a minute, they saw they were carrying this too far. It was a hoax. And they hopped up, and, you know, I was into the grief. And you can't take grief away from an alcoholic, you know. They're eating the ketchup. They're trying to prove that they're not dead. You can't convince me. They took me into the house where my older brother was, who, on several occasions, would punch me in the face so that I could see clearly, his way of working with others. So he knocked me around a little bit to try to get me to come to, and I just took off my clothes and started throwing up. So they just threw me in the bedroom and closed the door. And I told you my dad had come home. Just heard Chuck C. Just took David. Was told I had a headache. And he went into the room. And my hair was long then like it is now. And I had eaten that night. I hadn't eaten in a few days. I had spaghetti. So I was lying in the sea of pasta. And my dad carried me out into the living room and asked these kids, you know, for God's sake, what's wrong with her? And they said, she's got a headache. And I told you already, you know, I didn't really do drugs. He thought I had taken a bunch of pills and had overdosed. And I didn't do them because they're dangerous and they can kill you. So he just threw me in the car, rushed me over to the hospital. They started to pump my stomach. I did it for myself, all over my dad, all over the doctor. At some point, I sat up for just a moment, and I said, oh, F, I'm drunk again. And I passed back out. I came to the next morning. Oh, when I was in the hospital, and I looked like I had been terribly beaten up because of that walk I had gone on. And my brother's help. And the doctor just looked at my father and said, Mr. Steckdahl, I'm sorry, but we're going to put a 72-hour hold on your daughter. She's obviously trying to kill herself, and she's not far away from doing that. We're going to send her over to Kellogg Mental Institution. They've got a great adolescent unit. So he said, I know, I run it. And he brought me home. I was in a blackout. Sorry, my gum's getting stuck. I was in a blackout for 3 days. I came out of that blackout for the last time being shoved into the back of the Chevy Nova, and I was driven from Riverside, where I was living at the time, to Pomona, to the Triangle Club for my first meeting. And back then, the freeways didn't connect, so it was about a 45-minute drive. It was in January. It was dark, and it just seemed like that ride took 3.5 weeks. I got to the Triangle Club. I sat in the back of that room, and I was still vomiting. I was told the first 2 days sober that I slept in the bathroom with my head up on the toilet bowl or wrapped around it. You know how that feels so good, the cold floor. One of the times I came out of that blackout was for a few minutes when my dad picked my face up off the toilet and poured milk or buttermilk down me. And, of course, threw it right back up, and I looked up at him, and he was just crying. And he didn't say anything, and I couldn't. And I remember he just put my face back down on the toilet. So when I got to that meeting on a Monday night, I was in bad shape. I was still throwing up. I was shaking. I could not say the word alcoholic. I stammered on it for about 30 days. And I remember a lady named Martha came up, and she talked to me after the meeting, and Martha was just beautiful. Kind of looks like Peggy or Marlena, just beautiful and had makeup on and a nice soft voice. And I don't remember too much of what she said. I remember her saying something about drugs, and I said, I drink. But that's what I remember from my meeting with Martha. I don't remember anything that was said during the meeting. I just remember Martha was beautiful. She was clean. She'd like probably showered that very day, you know. Now, I'm sure they said it. I don't remember hearing it, but I'm sure they said, don't smoke pot. But I thought, that's how you stay sober. Right? How else do you not drink? How else do you stay sober? So I asked this old timer named Lyle. He was about 6'5", 6'6", and he had 6 months of sobriety. I asked him if he wanted to go outside at break and smoke this great J I had. And he picked me up and stood me on a chair so we could have eye-to-eye counsel at the top of his lungs. And he said, not only do we not drink in AA, we don't smoke dope, we don't take pills, and we seldom shoot heroin. I just said, don't you think that's a little extreme? And I'll tell you, that was one of my dark days, because I knew there's no way you feel the way that I feel when I'm sober. And I just knew I couldn't have this thing. And even when I heard your answers, they didn't make sense. Thinking, how could that possibly work? What does that mean, get to the meeting an hour early? What does that mean, shake hands? How is that? Have you heard my problems? Have you not heard what I've said? I told you I had 9 sponsors in my first 2 years, so I had a slight attitude problem. I have not always been the delicate flower that you see before you, and I think the only thing I had going for me was I went to a lot of meetings. I got kicked out of a couple of high schools sober. I didn't stay in any town for more than about 3 months. I had one feeling that floated through my consciousness, and that was the feeling that I've got to go now. So I'd pack up my box and I would go. By the time, I figured the answer, I need to move to Oregon. It's peaceful and calm and beautiful, and I got there and my head was just so loud. And I remember looking around just going, God, I hate nature. I had a job at Sambo's as a waitress. Was not real people-oriented at this stage of my sobriety. For some reason, they let me go. I like the idea of people. So I'm 2 years sober. I was more anxious, obnoxious, hostile, angry, than I had ever been. Prime relationship material. So the second his girlfriend went to Hawaii, I made my move. She was an Al-Anon, so I figured she could just release him. Help where I can. We broke up and got back together about 18 times for the group. You know, give them something to talk about at coffee, get out of themselves. We did that for 5 years, and he went back out. Fortunately for me, the only thing I had going stronger than my obsession for him was I finally had a relationship with my sponsor, and I had a home group. And that was a rough year. He was gone a year, and he started coming back to the meetings, and we started glancing at each other from across the room, and I got pregnant. I had always hated children. So I was real nervous about what kind of mother I was going to become, and so was everybody who knew me. On September 23rd, I went into labor. My husband John and I went to the hospital, and John called, you know, everybody on the Lamaze list. So I had AA people walking in and out of my labor room all night while I was laying there trying to look good. 16 and a half short hours later, Daniel was born. And when Daniel was born, he came out, he was screaming his head off. And the first thought that crossed my mind was, let me hold him so I can make him feel better. And I'd never felt that way about anything in my entire life. And he's one of the greatest gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. He's now 6'5", and I'm a grandmother. Just fantastic. John and I, when Dan was about a year old, he started using again and never got sober for any length of time. We'd get 30 days, 60 days, 30 days, 90 days, 30 days. And we split up, and he still just couldn't put any time together. And 11 years ago this summer, he overdosed right before our son's 11th birthday. And that was a rough few years. Now, if you're new, I want to tell you this. I still get crazy sometimes. I still get very depressed sometimes. I have not risen above human emotion. I would tell you one thing. That is, I guess, the gift of time. I don't make lifetime decisions based on those things any longer. And I have a degree of peace that really, for me, should be unattainable. I told you I met my mother when I was 1 year sober. I mishandled it, and when I was about 12, 13 years sober, after going through the steps in the book, I made amends to her, and she's in my life today. She lost custody of us because of her drinking, and I love what Chuck used to say. He said, this is not a self-help program. He said, you don't need to boost your self-worth You don't need to increase your self-esteem. He said, I don't need a better image of myself. I need to not think about myself. And that's where my solace is. I've not had a problem get better yet for my working on it. If you asked me if I wanted a relationship with my mother, I would have honestly told you no. That I didn't miss her, I didn't care, and it doesn't matter. And that looked like the truth. I went to therapy while I was drinking, and they said that I was abandoned, which I know now that I was spared. I know that she loved me enough to stay away from me. And as a result of working these steps and consistent actions that Clancy made me take, you restored her dignity as a mother. Thank you. A few years ago, I got a job as a flight attendant. I don't think I'm allowed to say what airline I work for, but we fly to Alaska a lot. And I remember in training, you know, they told us, you know, you give people who are not doing what they are supposed to do an option. So you present them with the right answer, and then you give them an alternative, which is a horrible option. And then you ask them, which would you like to do? They naturally pick the right answer. And then you smile. So they gave me a mock-up plane, and, you know, they had all kinds of disasters in there. And so I had a mother with the baby in the exit row, which is a no-no. So I said, would you like to move your child back a couple of rows where you will be safe? Or would you like me to put your baby in the overhead bin? Smile. For some reason, they hired me, but so I get to see my mom a lot. My time is up. I just want to say, if you're new, welcome. We're glad that you're here. And I promise you it will get better. That you're not alone. You do get better. My experience, it takes a really long time and a lot of uncomfortable work. I want to thank Marita for housing me, clothing me, Michael for being my chauffeur, and Heidi for inviting me. Thank you.